Ladies and gentlemen, we take you now by direct wire to the Shrine of the Little Flower, Royal Oak, Michigan, for the regular Sunday afternoon program of Father Charles E. Coughlin.
Gentlemen, today Father Coughlin will speak to you on the subject, Communism Accepts Religion. And while Father Coughlin is preparing to come to the microphone, the Little Flower Choristers, under the direction of Emil Cote, sing for us by transcription, O Sacred Heart Surrounded, by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Thank you.
and gentlemen, once more may I plead for patience on the part of the many thousands of persons who have written to Father Coughlin during the past few weeks. Every letter will be answered, and every request for the literature which was advertised will be filled as soon as scores of clerks can perform this task. Those of you who are newcomers in this audience are invited to write directly to Father Coughlin for a copy of today's address. He will be glad to mail it to you at his own expense. Nevertheless, may I remind you that this radio hour is paid for at full commercial rates and is dependent for its continuance upon the support of the interested persons in this audience. If you care to address a letter to Father Coughlin this week, direct it to him at Royal Oak, Michigan. And now may I present our reverend speaker in his address entitled Communism Accepts Religion, Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, one evening last week, I was privileged to entertain several gentlemen who came to my home to discuss the trend of current events. The conversation touched upon such subjects as the Russo-Finnish War, the manifestations of radicalism in the ranks of labor, its appearance in the halls of government, education, and religion. Gradually, the conversation centered upon communism, its causes, its rapid development, its abject materialism, and particularly its professed atheism and irreligion. While all the gentlemen present granted that communism likely would undergo a transformation, they were not prepared for the startling observations expressed by one individual who predicted that communism was about to reverse itself by advocating the practice of religion. In fact, this gentleman, bolder than the others, expressed the opinion that communism as we knew it in 1917 and thereafter was passé. Asked for an explanation, he replied, Lenin, Trotsky, Belakun, and all the early leaders in the movement were guilty of innumerable mistakes. Relative to their policy of fire and sword, they found out that the blood of martyrs was the seed of Christians. They learned that one cannot exterminate Christianity from the face of the world by physical persecution. And as for their program of atheism and irreligion, the day is fast approaching when communism, instead of being opposed to religion, will support it. Soon the better informed communists will abandon Lenin's dictum that religion is the opium of the people. They will adopt the attitude that without religion, there can be no communism, unquote. That was a challenging statement, which demanded an explanation. For practically all the assembled gentlemen countered with questions to this effect, namely, that communism was totally materialistic, caring nothing for the spiritual life. That it is concerned in no manner with the immortal soul. That it is devoted entirely to propositions related to bread, shelter, clothing, and national prosperity. Therefore, communism and religion were irreconcilable terms. All these contentions were readily admitted, but they were countered by the gentleman with the statement that the leaders of communism are rapidly evolving a religion, a popular religion designed to appeal to the popular mind, a materialistic religion acceptable by a materialized people. As the discussion continued, we were reminded how Rosenberg, the philosopher of the Nazi movement in Germany, insisted upon a revival of religion. A pagan religion, if you will. We were reminded of Earl Browder's overtures to the Catholic workingmen of America. We were reminded of the pacific attitude adopted by certain radical labor leaders towards the religious leaders in America. This matter was discussed at some length, following which it was conceded that if and when communism appears in England, France, and America, it will certainly differ considerably from its first crude manifestations in Russia, Hungary, and Mexico. Through a process of evolution, it will abandon its greasy overalls, as it were, and appear in the evening dress of a cultured, polished citizen. Despite this explanation, there still existed serious doubts as to the probability of communism recognizing or adopting a religion. At length, when pressed for an opinion on this matter, I recall for my guests an incident which I experienced almost 30 years ago when I was registered at the University of Toronto. Following out an old custom, the university authorities invited the famous English cleric, Father Bernard Vaughan, to address the students. Father Vaughan, for your information, was one of the most outstanding Jesuits of the last generation. While I do not remember any of the contents of the Reverend Speaker's lecture, there still remains a vivid recollection of several remarks which he made to a small group of students following his speech. Let me explain. In our studies, we had become acquainted with the name of Karl Marx. We had reviewed in the classrooms his book, Das Kapital. To us, communism was nothing more than a theory, as impossible in practice as is the theory of perpetual motion. One of the students questioned Father Vaughan as to what he thought of Karl Marx and communism. His terse reply was this: "Haven't you read my friend's book? I mean his novel, The Lord of the World?" Not one of us had read the book. Not one of us knew of its existence, probably. So we inquired further, "Who wrote The Lord of the World, Father?" And we were informed that the author was Father Robert Hugh Benson. Father Benson has given a rather clear picture of what communism will be in years to come, said Father Vaughan. "You must get that book and read it. It is already 3 or 4 years old." So ended our brief interview with the famous Father Bernard Vaughan. Naturally, among other students, I procured a copy of The Lord of the World and found that it had been published in the year 1907, 33 years ago. To this book, at least, to that part of it which touches upon the religion of communism, may I refer at some length today. Now, probably many of you in this audience have read Father Benson's book. It is a novel of the type which indulges in predictions. The Reverend author, looking ahead as far as 50 years or so, dramatically portrayed the story of the future. He forecast the exact date of the World War, referring to it by the name of the Great Massacre. He predicted the rise of socialism through the agency of labor parties. He previsioned the appearance of a new social order in Germany, to be followed by one in England and elsewhere. He prophesied the passage of new laws related to the poor and to the unemployed. He foretold how private property would be socialized, or municipalized, the word he uses, chiefly through the agency of heredity taxes. And finally, he pictured the dissolution of nationality through the formation of the United States of Europe, over which vast territory one man by the name of Julian Felsenburgh would gain control through the sheer brilliance of his intellectual power. These predictions were made in the year 1907. Since that date, 33 years ago, some nations already have nationalized the professions. Others have municipalized the railways and legally have limited profits. Others have established old age pensions. And many of them have entered upon a program of communizing private wealth through the process of inheritance taxes. These things Father Benson foresaw as he incorporated such thoughts in the pages and chapters of The Lord of the World. And now in 1940, diplomats from many nations are consulting with one another as to how they can establish the United States of Europe, a new United States dedicated to democracy, to brotherhood, to peace and prosperity, a new political unit wherein the animosities of nationality will find no expression. This was the concept of the final development of communism as set down in the chapters of The Lord of the World. A universal democracy dominated by the mind of one man, an order of life patterned upon the rights of man and fashioned entirely upon the principles of materialism and naturalism. Particularly did this gifted priest, Father Benson, insist that communism, which was so fantastic to the minds of his contemporaries and so foreign to our minds, who identify it with massacres, irreligion and mass poverty, particularly did Father Benson insist that it would gain the approval of the multitudes through the agency of an appeal made on the basis of a materialistic or naturalistic religion. This story and the analysis of the now 33-year-old Lord of the World I unfolded to my guests, and acting under their persuasion, I am retailing it to you today. Ladies and gentlemen, for the moment, let us put aside our preconceived legal definition of a communist. I mean, for the moment, let us cease calling him a member of a political party. And let us begin appraising him as a believer in the principles of Karl Marx, even though he carries no identification card in his purse. And for the moment, let us speculate on this question. How will communism manifest itself 15 or 20 years hence? the communism that your children will be forced, perchance, to accept as a part of their social lives. And in considering this question, let us appreciate three remarkable modern phenomena. First, the widespread rejection of supernatural religion, even in so-called Christian countries. Second, the widespread poverty experienced by the masses of populations which do not practice religion. And third, the widespread movement in every nation to acquire an adequate share of the potential wealth which the world is capable of producing. In fine, there is a tendency in the modern world to rebel against the economies of the past. And this tendency is supported by millions of persons who either have abandoned the practices of Christianity or who refuse to follow them. With these thoughts in mind, let us proceed. 10 years following the publication of Father Robert Hugh Benson's book, The Lord of the World, came the Russian Revolution. 1917 will long be remembered for its confiscation of lands, properties, and factories, for its slaughter of millions upon millions of Christians, for its Lenins, Trotskys, and Belakuns, the commissars of atheism, and the apostles of worldwide revolution. The year 1940, with Russia cooperating with Germany, impresses upon us this significant thought, namely, that communism, be it brown or red, as yet has not run its course. Its more influential leaders are speaking of God, a God not identified with our God. They are sounding high words in praise of justice. They are exhibiting much concern for humanity. In 1940, we find the entire world dividing its forces into two camps. Possibly, within another 12 months, there will be no nation outside the orbit of the New World War, a world war advertised by the opponents of Christianity and supernatural religion as being fought to overthrow capitalism and imperialism, regarded by Russia and Germany as the causes of poverty and exploitation. A world war advertised by the other side as a holy war, a crusade for God and justice, fought by millions who have abandoned the supernatural religion of God. The year 1940, with its strange contradictions, soon will be history. The year 1950 soon will dawn upon us. And with its coming, it is possible that the new creation, the United States of Europe, will be brought into existence, and a new social order divorced from supernatural religion, opposed to rugged individualism, will be legislated into being. Possibly by 1950, we will have a clearer understanding of the dramatic sentence pronounced by Pope Pius XII when he said, "If war, all may be lost." Now I know that these are morbid thoughts with which I am giving expression. Nevertheless, they are thoughts pertinent to our time. These are engaging thoughts, nevertheless, which should shock the apathetic out of their complacency. There are millions of persons, so we all know, who are determined that the old order will pass because it was identified with needless poverty, with wicked war, and with universal insecurity. A new order is demanded by them. A universal peace is demanded by them. But what of the old order antedating the rugged individualism against which the forces of communism are prepared to fight, either with bullets or ballots? What of the old order of Christ's supernatural religion? Will it be vanquished? Will millions of Christians abandon their faith in Christ and in Christ's teachings? Will these millions join with those now in the majority who already have abandoned it and, concluding that Christianity failed to renovate the face of the earth, will they give their allegiance to the new materialistic social order which is seeking recognition? These questions are troublesome to most minds. Like Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, most of us are inclined to say, I will think of them tomorrow. Tomorrow. Let me read a passage from The Lord of the Worlds, Chapter 4, Part 2, and catch a glimpse of the tomorrow as Father Robert Hugh Benson pictured it. The Great War had come to a close. The United States of Europe is a reality. On every hand, swords are being beaten into plowshares. Political parties, more or less, have disappeared. And an enforced one-party form of government is functioning under the guise of democracy. Julian Felsenburgh has been requested to accept the presidency of the United States of Europe. Under his direction, a new prosperity was dawning upon the world. A calm, a serenity was apparent on every hand. It was a serenity robed in the vestments of a new religion, approved of by Felsenburgh, a religion which worshipped maternity, life, food, shelter, clothing, together with paternity, the symbol of physical health and sensuality. As yet, this new religion has not been established in England. Julian Felsenburgh had promised the English people that he would come to place his signature upon the Bill of Worship just passed by Parliament. Thus, we find ourselves standing in a crowded corridor of the House of Commons, waiting for the President of the United States of Europe to make his appearance. Just below, in the gallery, is seated the wife of one of the English commissars. And just below her is the president's vacant chair. Father Robert Hugh Benson writes as follows, quotation, Mabel, seated in the gallery that evening behind the president's chair, had already glanced at her watch half a dozen times in the last hour, hoping each time that 21 o'clock was nearer than she feared. She knew well enough by now that the President of Europe would not be half a minute either before or after his time. His supreme punctuality was famous all over the continent. He had said 21, so it was to be 21. A sharp bell note sounded from beneath. And in a moment, the drawling voice of the speaker stopped. Once more, she lifted her wrist, saw that it wanted 5 minutes of the hour. Then she leaned forward from her corner and stared down into the house. A great change had passed over it at the metallic noise. All down the long brown seats, members were shifting and arranging themselves, uncrossing their legs, slipping their hats beneath the leather fringes. As she looked, she saw the president of the house coming down the 3 steps from his chair, coming down for another who would occupy that chair in a moment. The house was full from end to end. A latecomer ran in from the twilight of the south door and looked distractedly about him in the full light before he saw his vacant place. The galleries at the lower end were occupied too, down there, where she had failed to obtain a seat. Yet from all the crowded interior, there was no sound but a sibilant whispering. From the passages behind, she could hear again the quick bell note repeat itself as the lobbies were cleared. And from Parliament Square outside, once more, came the heavy murmur of the crowd that had been inaudible for the last 20 minutes. When that ceased, she would know that he had come. My friends, the days of the Napoleons are passing. In his day, men dreamed of conquering Europe by physical force. And Napoleon, the greatest of the dreamers, had failed. In our day, some men still dream of conquering the world by the crudities of physical force. But more and more it is becoming evident to the cunning leaders of radicalism that the better weapons are those of practiced propaganda. The pen will become mightier than the sword. The psychologist will become more powerful than the general. The book, the pamphlet, the press, and the radio, they will become more potent than the factories which fabricate shrapnel, torpedoes, lethal gas, and incendiary bombs. Eventually will come a Felsenburgh, skilled in his appeal to the masses, perfected in his approach to Parliament. Felsenburgh, the psychologist, the sociologist, the diplomat, all in one. Father Benson continues with the following quotation. How strange and wonderful it was to be here on this night of all when the president was to speak. A month ago, he had assented to a similar bill in Germany and had delivered a speech on the same subject at Turin. Tomorrow, he was to be in Spain. No one knew where he had been during the past week. A rumor had spread that his Volor, his airplane, had been seen passing over Lake Como and had been instantly contradicted. No one knew either what he would say tonight. It might be 3 words or 20,000. There were a few clauses in the bill,
notably those bearing on the point as to when the new worship was to be made compulsory on all subjects over the age of 7, it might be he would object and veto these. In that case, all must be done again, and the bill repassed, unless the House accepted his amendment instantly by acclamation. Mabel herself was inclined to these clauses. They provided that, although worship was to be offered in every parish church in England on the ensuing first day of October, this was not to be compulsory on all subjects till the new year. Whereas Germany, who had passed the bill only a month before, had caused it to come into full force immediately, thus compelling all her Catholic subjects either to leave the country without delay or suffer the penalty. These penalties were not vindictive. On a first offense, a week's detention only was to be given. On the second, 1 month's imprisonment. On the third, 1 year. And on the fourth, perpetual imprisonment until the criminal yielded. All these were merciful terms, it seemed. For even imprisonment itself meant no more than reasonable confinement and employment on government works. There was no medieval horrors here, and the act of worship demanded was so little, too. It consisted of no more than bodily presence in the church or cathedral on the four new festivals of maternity, life, sustenance, and paternity, celebrated on the first day of each quarter. Sunday worship was to be purely voluntary, unquote. Strange words are these, outlining a strange bill of worship. No longer are the communists bent upon preaching that religion is the opium of the people. Leaders have discovered that without religion, the people cannot be managed. Thus, we begin to understand the mouthings now proceeding from Moscow relative to the reestablishment of Christianity. We begin to understand Herr Hitler's references to God, to Christ. We begin to understand the new transformation which is taking place within the ranks of the leaders of communism. If Lenin and Trotsky and Belakun failed to appreciate the importance of religion in ruling the people, all their successors in office will be guilty of no such mistake. But a different religion it will be. A religion of the body, not of the soul. A religion of man, not of God. A religion of earth, not of heaven. But a religion it will be, even though for Christ there will be substituted the Antichrist. Its high priests will touch not the old cathedrals and their works of art, nor despoil the wayside chapels and parish churches. These will stand in all their ancient material splendor, shrines for the sentimental may visit to seek some respite from the throbbing world about them. But even these sentimental persons will be forced to deny the faith of their fathers by worshiping the new spirits of maternity, life, sustenance, and paternity. Else they will become modern slaves, forced to eke out their existence by sweating over government projects. And the wife of the English commissar continues to muse upon the following thoughts. Father Benson describes her perplexity in these words, quotation. She could not understand how any man could refuse this simple homage. These four things were facts. They were the manifestations of what she called the spirit of the world. And if others call that power God, yet surely these ought to be considered as God's function. Where then was the difficulty? It was not as if Christian worship were not permitted under the usual regulation. Catholics could still go to Mass. And yet appalling things were threatened in Germany. Not less than 12,000 persons had already left for Rome. And it was rumored that 40,000 would refuse this simple act of homage a few days hence. It bewildered and angered her to think of it. For herself, the new worship was a crowning sign of the triumph of humanity. Her heart had yearned for some such thing as this. Some public, corporate profession of what all now believe. She had so resented the dullness of folk who are content with action and never considered it spring. Surely, this instinct within her was a true one. She desired to stand with her fellows in some solemn place, consecrated not by priests, but by the will of man, to have as her inspirers sweet singing and the peal of organ, to utter her sorrow with thousands beside her at her own feebleness of immolation before the spirit of all, and to sing aloud her praise of the glory of life, to offer by sacrifice and incense an emblematic homage to that from which she drew her being, and to whom one day she must render it again. Ah, thought she, these Christians had understood human nature. She had told herself this 100 times. It was true that these Christians had degraded it, darkened light, poisoned thought, misinterpreted instinct. But they had understood that man must worship, or sink. Unquote. My friend, there is a supernatural religion. Among other things, it is based upon the principle that man finds his complete happiness only in heaven. Of his own ingenuity, of his own power, man cannot acquire perfect freedom, lasting prosperity, and eternal happiness in this world. It rests upon the thought that there is such a thing as sin, the cause of all our evil, of all wars. And because of the nature of sin, no man and no group of men can wipe it out. It's an infinite offense against God. Only an infinite person can liquidate it. Only God can accomplish this. only God and God's principles through supernatural channels can bring about eternal peace and happiness. Well, for that purpose, Christ came into the world. He surrendered his life upon Calvary's hill to pay the price for the sins of the world. He established a church, and he said to the prince of the apostles, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Now the reason for the existence of the church is to preserve the doctrines preached on the hillsides of Palestine, on the temple steps, in the upper room, from the pulpit of the cross, and in the assembly of the apostles, following the resurrection of Christ from the dead. Yes, there is a church established not only to perpetuate these doctrines, but to dispense the supernatural help without which we cannot proceed, without which we cannot be saved. The same church was established to battle until the end of time against sin, personal and social sin, through the perpetuation of Calvary sacrifice. That, in brief, is the framework of a supernatural religion brought into the world by Christ. That, in brief, might be accepted as an explanation of the Master's words when he said, "Without me you can do nothing." Yet, from that supernatural religion, millions of our fellow citizens have been lured. The words liberty, fraternity, and equality have become more important in our vocabularies than faith and hope and charity. I wonder, should one speak in more concrete terms? Should one be content to treat of this subject of communism in 1940 as our fathers did in 1907, considering it an impractical theory? If not, then pause with me for a moment. Here are the facts. The world wants peace. America, particularly, wants to stay out of the impending conflict. The citizens of our country want security. The entire nation is opposed to the concentration of wealth that exists under the practices of modern capitalism. Millions of men and women and children of our generation are existing in want, surrounded with plenty, because politicians and economists bow their knees before a hoard of gold buried in Kentucky. A hoard used to protect the bonds and the interest resulting from the World War and thereafter. But not used as it could be used to restore prosperity, to ensure security, to multiply production, and in the meantime, communism, with its materialism and naturalism, marches on. Long enough this nation has been patient in protecting that lifeless gold and in neglecting its suffering people. Yes, pause to consider these things. And in doing so, let us reaffirm that we Christians are concerned with the physical welfare of our people. For when a population is unnecessarily deprived of the necessities and immediate conveniences of this world through any program of economics which concentrates wealth, which worships gold and debts, and which considers financial rights more important than human rights, then that people will find it difficult to save their immortal souls. to accept supernatural religion. But Christianity goes further than this mere physical objective. Christianity goes farther than these materialistic ends. It is concerned ultimately and primarily with the salvation of one's immortal soul, which does not die. Thus the question is propounded today to all of us. It is this: if Christianity does not rise in protest against the injustices which have been perpetrated and protected throughout the world, particularly the injustices touching upon the economic and social life, what force can stem the advance of this insidious program of dress suit communism, whose object is to abolish these injustices? I ask you, shall a Felsenburgh, the embodiment of Antichrist, accomplish what the lovers of Christ fail to do in this material world? Shall we Christians be forced to relegate the principles of our religion to a simple wayside church whose pulpit has been silenced, and accept the pronouncements of the high priests of humanitarianism, whose star is rising in the ascendant? But on with the Lord of the world. For herself, the wife of the English commissar intended, so the book reads, to go at least once a week to the little old church half a mile away from her home, to kneel there before the sunlit sanctuary, to meditate on sweet mysteries, to present herself to that which she was yearning to love, and to drink, it might be, new draughts of life and power. Ah, but the bill must pass first. She clenched her hands on the rail, stared steadily before her on the ranks of heads, the open gangways, the great mace on the table, and heard above the murmur of the crowd outside the dying whispers within, her own heartbeat. She could not see him, she knew. He would come in from beneath through the door that none but he might use, straight into the seat beneath the canopy. Oh, but she would hear his voice. That must be joy enough for her. Oh, there was silence outside. The soft roar had died. He had come. And through swimming eyes she saw the long ridges of heads rise beneath her, and through drumming ears heard the murmur of many feet. All faces looked this way, and she watched them as a mirror to see the reflected light of his presence. There was a gentle sobbing somewhere in the air. Was it her own or another? The click of a door, the great mellow booming overhead, shock after shock, as the huge tenor bells tolled their three strokes, and in an instant, over the white faces passed a ripple, as if some breeze of passion shook the soul within. There was a swaying here and there, and a passionless voice spoke half a dozen words in Esperanto, out of sight. Englishmen, I assent to the bill of worship. Yes, Americans, I assent to the bill of worship. A new worship that deifies humanity. A diabolical worship which excludes the rights of God as it emphasizes the rights of man. An insidious worship whose dogma is democracy, and whose morals are materialistic. Not the democracy designated as Christian, not the morals concerned indirectly with the materialities of life, but the evolutionized democracy of totalitarianism, which manifests itself not only in the United States of Europe, but in the United States of the world, with one mind directing it, with one code inspiring it, the mind of Antichrist and the code of the flesh. My friends, it is time that we recognize that communism is in the state of transition. As I warned you before, so now I repeat, communism is doffing the overalls of persecution, physical persecution, of massacre, of confiscation, of direct confiscation. It is preparing to vest itself in the evening clothes of tolerance, of humanitarianism, its new religion. 1907, 1940. Possibly, Father Robert Hugh Benson was overly alarmed as a result of his studies of Marxism. Possibly not. Nevertheless, may I refer you to a book which forms, as it were, the final chapter of the Bible. You Protestants speak of it as the Book of Revelations. We Catholics call it the Apocalypse. In these our apocalyptic days, the days yet to come, when the Lord of the world will be incarnate, when even if possible the elect will be deceived, Antichrist will not ensnare men by parading evils, by upholding injustice, by advocating poverty and insecurity. Oh no, he the wolf will parade in the sheep's clothing of his seeming materialistic miracles to work his evil designs upon civilization, or what is left of it. So with these words and others, which probably are not appropriate for a microphone, the little gathering which assembled in my home last week to discuss the word-weary subject of communism took away with them the advice given to me 30 years ago by the preeminent Jesuit, Father Bernard Vaughan, who recommended at that time the reading of The Lord of the World to a group of simple students interested in the teachings of Karl Marx. And 30 years have passed. May the predictions pronounced by Robert Hugh Benson in 1907, may they come to naught in our lifetime as we resolve to bring about security, as we resolve to bring about financial liberty, as we resolve to bring about peace and prosperity, under the scepter of the real Lord of the world, Jesus Christ. And may the attempts on the part of the fictitious Lord of the world, may they perish. God bless you.
Ladies and gentlemen, once more may I remind you that printed copies of today's address are available at no charge. Direct your letters to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. He will be happy to acknowledge them and to fulfill your requests. And again, may I repeat a portion of the preliminary announcement. If in the past 2 or 3 weeks you have been one of the hundreds of thousands requesting him to mail you literature,